before we start, I'd like to acknowledge the original owners of this land, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, the past and the present and the future. Thanks for coming along for this at this event hosted by Melbourne University as part of the Australia's Role in the World lecture series in partnership with Australia's the International Institute of International Affairs and UN Youth Australia. It's also the launch of the Live Below the Line campaign at Melbourne University, and I'm extremely excited tonight to talk about the issue of extreme poverty and global injustice and the role that we play in that problem. To start with, I'm going to speak about Live Below the Line as a campaign, introduce it to the audience for 5 or 10 minutes, and try to pull the lid off the campaign and speak briefly about what has driven the success of Live Below the Line over the last 2 years. Then Peter and myself will talk, answer a few questions about the extreme poverty and the role the Western world plays in that, before fielding some questions from the audience, and hopefully we'll wrap up around 7 or just past 7 o'clock. So if everyone could please turn off their mobile phones before we begin, that'd be great, so it doesn't interfere with all of these awesome sound stuff we've got going on. So yeah, let's kick into it. So at 11:55 p.m. on the 16th of May last year, I was counting down the minutes to midnight when my Live Below the Line campaign was going to end. I'd spent the last 5 days eating on just $2 a day to step into the shoes of what it's like for people in the developing world who have to live their entire lives on the equivalent of that amount in Australia. As the seconds ticked by, I started to reflect on the 5 days I'd had and realised that while I could go back to my soy chai lattes in the Grave Street and spaghetti Napolitana at Pellegrini's, there were 1.4 billion people in the world who not only hadn't even heard of these things, but would never be able to access these sort of foods that we luckily have in Australia. And so what I realised was, through taking the Live Below the Line challenge, was that people in the developing world are stuck in a situation of impossible choices. It's impossible to choose between feeding your daughter that morning and sending your son off to school. It's impossible to choose between providing urgent medical attention to one of your children when all three of them need that attention. It's a situation of impossible choices in the developing world. Whereas here in Australia and other countries in the Western world, all we have is choices. So that's what Live Below the Line was born in 2010 by two Melburnians in the back in their backyard. And since 2010, it's grown from a backyard idea into a campaign that hopefully this year will raise $2 million and involve 10,000 people across Australia. Australia's fastest growing anti-poverty campaign. And so I suppose the idea behind it is that people take 5 days to step into the shoes, like a lot of people in this room already have and hopefully will sign up to participate this year, step into the shoes of people living in extreme poverty and get a unique insight into what that means and the choices that they don't have. Yeah, so that's sort of the idea behind the campaign. And by taking part, you raise funds as well. You have your own profile online, and you raise money to support the educational work of the Oak Tree Foundation, Australia's largest youth-led aid and development organisation. So where does the money go through Live Below the Line? As I said, it goes to support the Oak Tree Foundation's work in helping to tackle extreme poverty. It goes towards projects on the ground, like those in the community of Yangus and Kumbaretta, two really isolated isolated communities in the highlands of Papua New Guinea, a country where the average life expectancy of any individual is 57 years of age. In Australia, it's close to 87. where the average income is just over $2,000 per year for each individual, whereas in Australia, it's close to $35,000 per year. So money raised through Live Below the Line, through small and big donations, go towards supporting projects on the ground in communities like this, funding teachers, infrastructure, so teachers can actually live in the same place that their school is and they don't have to travel for 5 or 6 hours each time they have to attend the school, and provide scholarships to students that wouldn't otherwise have access to that education, and of course other resources and infrastructure that is needed on the ground in developing countries. So that's sort of the brief overview of the campaign, but I wanted to take an extra couple of minutes looking at why Live Below the Line has actually grown from being just an idea to being a real powerhouse anti-poverty campaign, not only in Australia, but now internationally in the UK, the US and New Zealand. Firstly, to touch on, I suppose, the concept itself, the idea of eating on $2 a day for 5 days is intimately connected with the cause that Live Below the Line supports. It's actually a very, very accurate representation of what it means to live in extreme poverty. Yes, people in the developing world have to, their $2 has to stretch a lot further than just food or drink, but it's a good, accurate representation in Australia. So what we find is our participants, our hopefully 10,000 participants this year in the campaign, are deeply connected with the cause that they're supporting. And what this means is they are the best advocates for this type of cause and this type of campaign that we will ever see. Which is really exciting, and we've found it's expressed in a whole bunch of ways. A large percentage of our participants raise significant amounts of money and have conversations. Last year, we had conversations we judged over 300,000 conversations across Australia with different people about the issue. So that's something that's really been vital in spreading this campaign. Secondly, which good segue, the idea of conversations about the campaign itself, but also about the issue of extreme poverty. An idea behind this is that to sign up and participate in take on the challenge and buy $10 worth of food and map out what daily your meal plan is going to look like for the 5 days is actually quite a large ask. Like, it's quite difficult to eat on $2 a day for 5 days, and it takes some time and energy. So people invest their whole of person to this campaign, and it's amazing. It's amazing to see how public taking on the Live Below the Line campaign is. It's very different to sort of the classic clicktivist or slacktivist type of campaigning that some people see pros and cons in. It's a very public facing, and it consumes your parts of your life for the 5 days, and that's really instrumental in creating all of these conversations and spreading the campaign virally. Lastly, something we try to foster through Live Below the Line is community levels and also community layers. So I'll try not to touch on this for too long, but when you sign up, you have access to a whole bunch of press releases, posters, business cards, postcards. All of these are resources at your fingertips to help you engage deeper with the campaign itself and take your campaign to more people and raise more money. And so through Live Below the Line, we try to incentivize that as much as possible and create as many Australians taking part at a deep level rather than 100,000 Australians only participating one of the 5 days a week and only raising $20 or $50. So we really try to create those levels of engagement and incentivise people engaging with the campaign at a whole new level. Lastly, the last point to touch on in part B of community would be when you sign up, you can sign up as part of the Melbourne University network. And after you've signed up as part of the Melbourne University network, you can start a team within that network, like a sub-network within the network, which might be the team of people that attended the lecture with Peter Singer on April the 3rd. And so you create that team, and you have a connection with the people in that team, but also the people in the broader network of Melbourne University. And you also have a connection with the broader network of people actually participating in Live Below the Line. And so we try to foster this situation where our participants feel that they're connected with a whole bunch of different sub-communities and larger, wider communities within the campaign itself. Because it's a hard challenge to take, especially hard to take it by yourself. So we like to try and find out ways for people to feel that they're connected with a whole bunch of different people across Australia. And that sort of network, that web of activity, has been instrumental in taking LBL from a $200,000 campaign to hopefully a $2 million campaign this year. So I suppose there's some key strategies behind what's taken the campaign, and I thought it would be worthwhile to touch on them rather than just sort of sing praises of the campaign itself, because I reckon there's a lot of people in this room who've heard about LBL, and as the last slide indicates, you can go to the website to find out information yourself and have a read. And feel free to drop us a line, info@liftbelowtheline.com, if you have any further information. So, yeah, thank you for hearing about Lift Below the Line, and hopefully I've shed a little bit of light on what drives the campaign itself rather than necessarily sort of what the campaign is. So, thank you. So now we'll go, Peter, we'll ask a few questions. How are we for time? Fantastic. Welcome, Peter. Thank you so much for taking
the
time.
Pleasure to be here.
Really appreciate it. Firstly, I wanted to ask, in the life you can save, you advocate and talk about extreme poverty as more than just a lack of material goods, but more a situation of pervasive hopelessness, I suppose. What's your reflection on what that means in the day-to-day lives of people that live in extreme poverty, and how destructive do you see the extreme poverty cycle to be?
Right, good question. But first, let's be clear. We're talking about something like 1.4 billion people, and anything that you try to say is a generalisation across all of those people is not going to hold for everyone. So there'll be people who are in extreme poverty, but perhaps are more hopeful than others because they may have different circumstances and different opportunities. But I think for very many of these people, the problem is that they are living in a state of insecurity in a whole variety of ways. Most obviously, insecurity about, are they going to be able to put food on the table, not just today and tomorrow, but next month, or perhaps there's a season of the year before the harvest comes in when they know they might have difficulty. So there's insecurity in that way. Also, though, there may be insecurity in that because they're the poorest of the poor, they are in a very weak position with regard to, say, the protection of the law, if the law reaches even to their area. And it may be that other more powerful people are able to exploit them and they have no redress. And it may be that attempts for them to work their way out of poverty are, you know, really doomed, and they may feel hopeless about that because, for one reason or other, they're in debt to the local money lenders and they're not going to be able to get out of that. Or just they can't, even if they were to grow more and produce more, they can't send it to a market because there's no roads or no infrastructure, and maybe they can't store it well in a way that is protected from pests or something of that sort. So it's a situation of feeling that they are living in this way and they don't very often see any clear way out of that. And that's very different from being poor in a society like Australia, where many people do feel that there's all sorts of possible ladders up to get out of their situation, and therefore they're much more hopeful. And of course, they do have a basic security that the extreme poor don't, both a security because of the protection of the law, which is certainly maybe still biased against the poor, but not to the same extent. And of course, there is a security net if, you know, they're not going to really have to worry about starving, let alone being without safe drinking water or something like that.
So often it's a situation where not people aren't even knowing the first place to start. To help them live.
That's right. Yes, that's right. They feel they're in a trap. People often refer to the poverty trap. And if you could somehow break out of that cycle, I mean, it can happen with farmers, say. They get very poor yields. Why? Well, they don't put on any fertiliser. Why don't they put on any fertiliser? They don't have any cash to buy fertiliser. And Jeffrey Sachs, the Columbia University economist, has got involved with a project that gives them fertiliser for 1 year. They get bigger crops, and then they've got some cash if they are in a situation where they can take their surplus to market, and then next year they can buy fertiliser themselves. So, you know, that's a sense in which it's a trap. You need some help to get out of that situation.
Yeah. What What about our ethical responsibility, I suppose, as individuals in playing a role to help end that trap you speak about and help end extreme poverty? Where do you see our role in that?
Well, I think there's lots we can do because we do have really quite a lot of spare resources. Most Australians, at least the majority anyway, I know there are some for whom this would not be, but most Australians do have money to spend on luxuries, you know. Mm. You mentioned your soy chai latte or whatever it was, and funny you mentioned the spaghetti at Pellegrini's. I've certainly had a lot of that over the years. It's been going, it's a real Melbourne institution. It's been going since I was probably around your age or something. So that's great, and we can do that, and we don't even think too much about that. I mean, that's not a really expensive restaurant, right? Mm. So, but as you pointed out, that's more than they would have to live on for a week or so. So they can't afford that, but we can. And that means that we have this spare margin that we can help them in some of the ways that I've already mentioned, like we can support Jeffrey Sachs's thing is called Millennium Promise. It's to try to keep the promise of the Millennium Development Goals, which were set in 2000, and various targets to be fulfilled by 2015, which is getting awfully close. And he's trying to show on a limited scale that you can do it. So you can do that and provide fertilizer for people that help them get out of the poverty trap. You talked about education in the New Guinea projects. You can help to provide schools so that children can get an education, and that's a way of escaping the poverty trap. You can provide some basic health care, which is going to save lives and avoid that excruciating dilemma you mentioned that a family might be in where all their children are ill but they only have the money to take one child to the doctor. I mean, what an awful situation that is. And those things can be prevented for relatively modest amounts of money by our standard. Mm.
What's the extent, I suppose, of that obligation? You've mentioned a spectrum of different ways, but what is the extent of that obligation to help out the poor?
Well, that's a good question, and in one sense you could say, well, look, gee, if you can live below the line on $2 a day for 5 days, why can't you live below the line for 365 days each year and think how much more money you would then have to contribute to these projects? And in some sort of ideal sense, I think it would be true to say that that's what you ought to do. But in another sense, that's just, we know that people are not going to do that. Unfortunately, we're not, overwhelmingly, we're not made so that we're prepared to be that altruistic and prepared to live and really give up all of those little frills and luxuries that we have. So I think you have to be realistic because that's the way in which you actually are going to raise the most amount of money. And I'm sure that's why, you said, well, you're doing it for 5 days, not one, because you want to make a more serious commitment, but you're not doing it for 365 because then you wouldn't get 10,000 people doing it. You'd be lucky to get 10 people doing it, probably. So you'll raise more money if you get 10,000 doing it for 5 days than 10 doing it for 365. I hope I got my maths right there. Yeah, I did. So I'm suggesting in this, I have this book, The Life You Can Save, and I set up a website, thelifeyoucansave.com. And in both the book and the website, I suggest a kind of progressive scale depending on how much you earn. And for most people, you'll be pleased to know, and this would certainly apply to all students, I would think, and generally most people, what I'm suggesting is something like 5% of your income, which I think most people who are middle class or above in Australia or other developed countries can give without really making any huge sacrifices. So I think it's realistic in that way. And if your income rises, well above the average income in Australia, then the scale goes up to 10 or 15 or 20% or whatever. But I think that those are realistic amounts. And what I say in the book and the website is that if you're giving according to those levels, you can feel you're making a substantial contribution, that you're doing something significant. You're not just dropping a few coins in a tin when it's rattled under your nose or something like that. And you can also feel that you're playing your part, that if everybody in the affluent world were to do that, that would raise, I've got some calculations there, but that would raise a really very substantial amount of money, which in the opinion of people who are better qualified than me, like Sachs and other economists, would be enough to achieve the Millennium Development Goals, in fact, more than enough, and gradually to phase out large scale anyway, extreme poverty. You wouldn't have 1.4 billion or even a billion, you know, maybe you'd have 100 million scattered in pockets around the world in extreme poverty. But you could do that for that sort of sum. So that's why I think you could feel that, okay, you're now living ethically, reasonably ethically, not perfect, you're not a saint, but you're living reasonably ethically with regard to global poverty. And by the way, if you do go to the website, you can pledge to meet that pledge, and we've got over 12,000 people who've pledged to do it so far. And the point of doing that is that the more people who pledge, there's lots of social science research showing the easier it is for others to join in, that people are more ready to do something when they see that others are doing it. And that's why I really hope that, you know, Live Below the Line gets a lot of attention and people see that 10,000 people are doing it, and next time it'll be easier to get 20 or 30,000 or more.
Yeah, definitely. One of the biggest, I suppose, barriers to that I've definitely come across to donating, working for a non-profit organisation, is people assume or say that the aid industry is corrupt and the aid and development sector, it doesn't work, aid's dead. My dollar, only 5 cents of that dollar is actually going to make an impact. How do you respond to these concerns often by donors?
Well, you're right, they're a very common concern, and I have to say, I find it frustrating that it keeps coming up. I remember, you know, I got exactly that from a talk show host when the book, The Life You Can Save, came out, and he said, well, look, you know, why should people give when, I think he said, only 10 cents in every dollar will go to the people who need it. And I said, where did you get that figure from? And of course he couldn't say, because there is no such figure. I mean, if you look at the major aid organisations that people are likely to give to, whether you're in Australia or the United States. I mean, say in Australia, it might be Oxfam, it might be Save the Children. You know, what are some of the others? The Hunger Project, there's a lot of things. And if you look at how much of that money actually goes to the people who need it, it's probably somewhere between 80 and 90%. So it's the other way around. It's 10 to 20% that goes for administrative expenses. And you shouldn't begrudge that either. I mean, it's a myth to think that if only aid societies could cut their expenses to 2%, then that would be a lot better. Because you have to think, well, how would they do that? I mean, they would have to cut staff, obviously. And if you cut staff, then either they're not handling your money properly, they're not sending you the receipts that you need for getting your tax deductions, and donors don't like that, or else, probably more likely, because the donors would be less likely to see it, they're cutting staff in the developing countries. And that means that they don't have people who are out there working with the local indigenous grassroots organisations to see what are the best ways we can help you, and to evaluate the projects, to say, well, has this really worked? Has this made you better off? Has this reduced infant mortality? Has this meant that you can now send your children to school? If you don't have people doing that, then things will go wrong. So I think we ought to say, yes, we need some administrative expenses, but don't believe these stories that, you know, most of the aid goes to corrupt dictators or something. I mean, these organisations don't give money to dictators or to, generally, they're working more directly at a village level. And the other thing I would say is, if you're interested in really finding out what money does and evaluating it, there's another website I'd recommend. It's called, it's an organisation called GiveWell, so givewell.org. It's an American organisation, so most of the organisation that is evaluating are probably American. But it shows you the kind of rigour that you can bring to evaluating what your money actually does. And it's a good way of finding some really effective organisations.
I suppose in a similar vein, but I want to go down a slightly different track, Peter. There's been a huge global response to, I suppose, the Kony 2012 campaign over the last couple of weeks, going from zero to 100 million views of their film in a week itself. Good and bad reception. It brought up the debate again between collectivism and actual activism. I wanted to ask, what do you make of this sort of explosion, and do you support Invisible Children?
So look, it's good that 100 million people watched anything about global poverty or the problems of the developing world. You know, that's good, because so often we just sort of don't look at that. We think, oh, that's going to be disturbing or going to make me feel guilty or whatever. You know, let's go back to viewing Justin Bieber or whatever.
He's the highest on YouTube.
So. Yeah, right. So obviously, even he, you know, Coney hasn't caught up with him still. But so that's good. And, you know, obviously they deserve praise for making a film that did have that impact and got out and got a lot of people thinking about this. But then the question is, so what can you do about this? You know, clicking is not really going to solve the problem. I think that's the problem with clicktivism. You have to do something more. And does Invisible Children have a plan to stop this situation? And then the other question, which goes back to what I was just saying, is this the most effective way in which you can save lives? And in fact, I mentioned GiveWell just a moment ago. So they have a comment on their website, which you can look at in more detail for this. And what they point out is that Coney is described by Invisible Children, so is responsible perhaps for the deaths of 30,000 children. It's a terrible thing when you think about it. 30,000 children, a football stadium full of children. You know, there's no doubt he's a simply monstrous person and should be stopped if that's possible. But 30,000 children is roughly the number of children who die from malaria every month in the developing world. And we do know how to stop children dying from malaria. A large part of it is distributing bed nets, and there are organisations that are doing that. And another part of it, because some children will still get malaria, is distributing the drugs to deal with it. And that can be done much more cheaply, much more effectively per life saved, I think, than anything that we could do to stop Coney. Because the other thing is, the focus on a single individual is a little misleading. It's not as if somehow if we get in there, we arrest Coney, we put him on trial and jail him, that it's going to stop. I mean, obviously there are other people in those groups who are doing that and may continue to do that, and there are other bands of brigands who are doing similar things. So we haven't really got a good handle on what to do to stop it and to do it in a way that doesn't use an exorbitant amount of resources. So the short answer to your question is no, I'm not financially supporting Invisible Children. I am financially supporting Against Malaria Foundation, which is one of the organisations recommended by GiveWell as one of the most effective organisations, one of the ones that will use your dollars most effectively to save the lives of children in developing countries.
Yeah, that's clear. I suppose more an Australian take. Over the past 5 years, certain parts of the world have undergone significant, financial shift. Since 2008, our Australian companies in particular have gone from being in a financial meltdown to now being more affluent, prosperous than they have ever been in some circumstances. But a lot of Australians haven't. The empathy for the world's poor hasn't really followed suit. How do you feel we can approach that apathy towards the issue of extreme poverty in the circumstances where we've just grown from being in a not so affluent time to being much more prosperous now?
Yes. Firstly, I guess not all Australians feel so much more prosperous now because we do have this two-speed economy, and people in the resources sector generally are doing well. People in manufacturing are not doing so well at the moment, and we've seen lots of headlines about manufacturing having to close, some manufacturers having to close down. Not everybody's feeling that affluent, but we are affluent, basically. There's no question about that. It's just that often people judge their affluence in terms like, how am I doing compared to how I was doing last year? And so that will affect the way people give. But I think it's a problem that generally we do not do enough to appreciate that we still are living very comfortable lives, that actually, as you say, we've done pretty well since 2008. And in any case, these little dips are really just small undulations at a level that is far above that of a fifth of the world's population. So that's what we need to think about, I believe. And I think we need to think about how can we as Australians be good global citizens? How can we play our part in solving some of the world's major problems? So we've seen, for instance, the government has finally taken some steps towards showing that Australia can do its part towards solving climate change, which is one of the greatest problems of the world. We haven't done enough, but at least we've taken some steps. But on global poverty, I think we're lagging. We're giving currently roughly 33 cents or something in every $100 we earn for official foreign aid. And that doesn't compare well with some of the other wealthy countries. Doesn't compare well with the Scandinavian countries or the Netherlands, which are giving closer to $1 in every 100. So we don't really do very well as a wealthy nation. And we could make up for that with individual donations. We could say, well, I'd like the government to give more, but since they're not, I'm going to make sure that I'm giving that 5% or whatever it is of my income. But it's so far, it's only a small number of Australians who are doing that. And that's one of the things that I hope we'll build, and one of the things that I hope Live Below the Line will encourage people not just to live below the line for those 5 days, but to make that kind of commitment that you were talking about, to have that deeper connection with people in extreme poverty, and to feel that they want to be doing something about that all year round.
I suppose Live Below the Line has two core parts to it. It's the way of tackling the issue of poverty for individuals in Australia. Firstly, raising money to support programs that are empowering people to break out of the poverty cycle. But then secondly, widespread education and awareness of the issue in Australia and that it matters. How do you see the balance being struck between both of these objectives in the struggle to end this global issue?
Well, I think that education is tremendously important. I mean, as long as you're actually doing it well, and it does seem that you're doing it well, because as you said, the campaign is growing from, was it 200,000 last year to...
In 2010,
a couple of years ago. Okay. So, I mean, if you're increasing awareness to that extent, that you're moving from raising 200,000 to hopefully raising 2 million, you're getting a lot more people involved. And what we're interested in is the long-run effect, that this will all go to, in the long run, to contribute to more aid being given in effective ways to help the global poor. So I think it's perfectly reasonable to invest some of that in educating people within Australia about these issues, because, goodness, we certainly need it. I mean, you people who've been good enough to come here tonight, no doubt, are perhaps already know more about it, better informed than most of the public. But we do need to reach out across Australia to people who are not at universities and in other communities who may be less well aware of it. And we need to really build up that sense that this is something we should do as a community and as individuals, that if we're to hold our heads up high, to be proud of what we're doing, to think of ourselves as an ethical society, we have to do something to change the world in which there's such enormous differences between those who are really wealthy like we are and those who are really poor. So I think it's important that you do some direct practical work so that people can donate to that and you can show that you can make a difference and that you're not just doing the education. But I think the education, while you're still in that expanding stage, is a very important thing to do.
I suppose one of the strongest ways that Live Below the Line provides that education, as well as other campaigns like 40 Hour Famine, for instance, is that experiential nature to
yeah.
it. How do you feel that experiential nature, the role that plays in the broader discussion of global poverty, and do you see it important part of the discussion?
Well, I think it is, but it's certainly different. I mean, one thing that you said, I think early on in your remarks, that I might take just issue with a little bit, is you said something like it's an accurate representation. You qualified that a bit, but I've certainly done I've done the 40-hour famine, for example, a few times. I haven't actually done Live Below the Line because of various travel things that I've got. Say this year that I can't do it. I'm leaving in the middle of that campaign, and it would be too difficult. But still, I know from my experience with the 40-hour famine that while you're hungry, and in that sense you're thinking, gee, there are lots of people who are food insecure and who at times do have to go without a meal for some period of time like this. I knew that at the end of that 40 hours I was going to be able to get food and that I would have a regular supply of food from then on. And just as you knew that at the end of the 5 days, you would be able to go and get your spaghetti at Pellegrini's. And also, of course, you knew that you were not going to be evicted from where you live, that there was not going to be some landlord who was going to close down on you. You knew that if someone in your family got ill, they were going to have free health care, or that if you fell ill, you would get that. You didn't have to worry about was your drinking water safe, or were you going to have to walk an hour to get drinking water. All of those things we can't really replicate. And that sense of, we started talking about this, that sense of hopelessness and insecurity that some people face is something that we really can't replicate by these campaigns. So I don't want to say that they're not important. I do think what I think is important really is that people feel they're making some non-monetary sacrifice to show solidarity with the global poor. And I think that's important because while giving money might in fact be the most effective way that we can really help people in a village in Malawi, let's say, feeling that you're doing something as well apart from giving money, I think has a strong emotional resonance. And it's that kind of thing that may give you a deeper commitment that really powers you through the long term, that this is not going to be just something you'll do once, but that this is something that will really change your life.
I suppose something that's important is that you're not just doing that non-monetary action, but you're doing it with other people as well.
Oh,
as
absolutely.
A community of you taking that action as well.
Exactly, and I think that's a terrifically important thing about what you're doing, because again, if you look at the psychological studies, one of the main factors that makes people contribute to charities or be altruistic is that their peer group does that too. So I think that's really important, that you have that peer group that is supportive, and so you can talk to other people and that you don't feel, well, you know, why am I doing this when nobody else around me is doing it, you know? Is there something wrong with me? Is there something odd about me? Because humans are, you know, we are really social animals. We never evolved as isolated individuals living by ourselves. We always evolved from primates which live socially. And so we have that sense of needing support from others. And I think what you're doing is you're providing a community of support that cuts against a lot of the other stuff that's out there in our society, all of the consumer-oriented advertising that says, you know, you must have this latest gizmo or you must do that. So you're providing a community that says, no, there are other good things that you can do with your resources.
Definitely. I suppose a last question to wrap it up from me before we go to the floor. We like to say at Live Below the Line and the Oak Tree Foundation, the organisation behind the campaign, that we're part of a movement to end extreme poverty and end global poverty. Over the last 20 years, we've been lucky enough to halve the number of people living in extreme poverty. I think it was about 2 or 3 weeks ago that the UN released updated data from 2008 that said we'd just dipped below 1.3 million people now under the extreme poverty line.
Billion,
sorry, yeah. Apologies. Definitely. That would be amazing.
That would be terrific. Yeah.
What do you see the vision for that ongoing? Are you optimistic that sort of progress will continue?
I am quite optimistic, yeah. There are some interesting indicators that are coming out showing that extreme poverty is reducing, as you mentioned, and that's very encouraging. And it's happening, you know, we've all read about China and how the Chinese economy has grown, and that's pulled hundreds of millions of people out of poverty, and that's terrific. And India is somewhat more of a mixed picture. Its economy has grown, but it doesn't seem that it's actually spread that much to some of the rural areas, but still, there are no doubt, you know, it's made some progress. But often people have the sense that sub-Saharan Africa is, you know, really a basket case and it's just too difficult to make progress there. But the figures actually are showing that that's not true, that the economies of sub-Saharan Africa are now growing reasonably rapidly and that this is helping to reduce the number of people living in extreme poverty there. And so that's really encouraging. And the other thing that I would specifically mention, I often focus in the talks that I give about this, about I tell a little story about passing a pond with a toddler in it, and somebody thinking I could save this child, but then, oh, I'm wearing my favourite pair of shoes and they'll get ruined, so I won't bother, I'll just walk on. And everybody thinks that would be monstrous, but what my point, of course, is that given that there are millions of children under five dying of poverty-related causes, if you're not giving to any organisation that's helping to reduce poverty or helping to save those children, you're just like the person who walks past the child drowning in the pond because you don't want to have to face up to the cost of a new pair of shoes. Well, because I used that example many years ago, I've been following UNICEF's figures on the number of children under five who die each year from avoidable poverty-related causes. And that's been coming down very significantly too. So that when I published The Life You Can Save, or rather when I sent the book to press, which was late 2008, I looked at the latest UNICEF figures and I said, I think just over 10 million children are dying each year of poverty-related causes. And then when the paperback came around, I updated it a year or so later, and it had fallen to under 10 million. It was 9.8 or something like that. And now I've looked at it again, and we're down to 8.8 million. So this is in really quite a short time. We're talking about 4 years now. And we've gone down, you know, saving more than the lives of more than 2 million children each year. And you think about that, you know, I mean, statistics sometimes get so large, but you try to think about that, the number of families who have not had to watch their child die because their child got measles, wasn't immunised, got measles, their child got malaria, there was no bed net, their child didn't have safe drinking water and got diarrhoea, and that can be a killer. You know, all of those things, or just their child wasn't properly nourished. We are making steady progress now. And I think that's terrific, and I really hope that, you know, we'll make that progress faster, and we will start to see a global movement to really focus on effective reduction in global poverty.
It opens up the imagination for me of how much faster we could be solving this problem if Australia and a couple of other the Western countries really took more of a lead in helping to end it. So
absolutely, yeah, that's what we need to do.
Definitely. Yeah. Great. That's enough questions from me, Peter. I wanted to open it up to the floor to shoot out some questions. Do we have some roving mics up on... We have one on the my right, audience left, and one on the right over there. Yeah, I think we'll probably go for about 15, maybe 20 minutes for questions, and then we'll hopefully wrap up by about 7:05. So, yeah, to the floor. Yeah, in the middle.
Thank you very much so far. You've talked a lot so far about what we can do, and I was just hoping that you would be able to address maybe how the aid is actually received. So, and I'm thinking from two particular perspectives. There's the issue of how when aid's given, it can often, I've heard a lot of critiques that aid can be seen as sort of an external solution imposed on an issue, and the aid that's given is not always fully understood. I'm thinking, say, solar panels get taken down and used as mirrors, or the mosquito nets get used as fishing nets. And the other issue on how aid's received is how that affects the wider governance issues with the state. So I was just hoping you could also address or discuss those issues.
Right, yeah. Yeah, you're probably thinking of that. There certainly have been some critiques of aid that have had some attention. There was a book by Dambisa Moyo called Dead Aid, which was critical of aid in those ways. And there was another book, the name has escaped me, the title is called The White Man's Burden. It's by a New York University economist so both of those books are critical of aid. But if you look for discussions of what we're talking about, that is non-government organisations' aid, they're basically non-existent. In those books. Actually, Dambisa Moyo at least has a footnote saying somewhere she's really only addressing government aid. And if you find that footnote, you realise that the arguments are against either sort of aid from World Bank, which gets indirectly from government, or direct government-to-government aid. And she's particularly worried about the idea that it relieves the governments of the need to have support from their people to raise taxes and in various other ways that it strengthens the hands of governments that may not be very good governments. And in The White Man's Burden, it's much the same. There's no discussion. And I actually asked the author when I was sort of having a conversation like this with him in a public event. That, and he said, there are too many NGOs and it's really too difficult to assess them individually as to whether they're effective or not. And I thought that was a bit of a cop-out. I think that really those criticisms don't, you know, they may apply to some official aid, possibly, and different countries have better programs, and I'm all in favour of reviewing our aid programs to make sure that they really are effective and that they don't just give money to governments that are not going to be helpful. I mean, if you look at, say, the United States foreign aid program, not quite sure how it is this year, but for the last several years, the largest recipients of foreign aid have been Iraq and Afghanistan. Well, why is that? It's not because they're the poorest countries in the world, particularly Iraq is quite oil rich, but it's because they were part of the war against terrorism, and it was serving America's interest to have aid going into those countries. So a lot of official aid does get kind of distorted by the political priorities of the governments. That, you know, it's unfortunate if that fact and books like those books I mentioned lead people into thinking that the kind of aid that they might give to Oxfam or Save the Children or one of those organisations is not going to be effective, because those organisations are not going to give money to governments. They're going to work at a more direct level. And therefore, the question that you rightly asked at the beginning, how do these people receive it? Well, they receive it very well because they're part of the planning and negotiating process. It's not that somebody comes in and says, here, you're going to have this in your village. It's rather that people come in and say, there are some people who would be willing to help you. Do you want help? And if so, what do you want help with? And then they may say, well, it'd be great if we had a well, because at the moment the women have to walk 2 hours a day to fetch water. So yes, you could help us with that, or, you know, these things. So I think the good aid organisations are quite sensitive to the point that lies behind your question.
To add another point as well, Peter, it's interesting to note, because there have been examples of unsustainable development work that was just going in, dropping off supplies or food. There's often, this does happen with NGOs that aren't as effective. But what I'm increasingly seeing in the aid and development sector, which would be really interesting to check out, Engineers Without Borders in Canada, very specific example, but they now release a report each year called the Failures Report. And it's really interesting to see more and more, development organisations talking about the mistakes they made and sharing that with their donors and people on the road to more effectiveness. And I think that's the sort of transparency which I'd definitely encourage.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Another question? Yeah, down the front here, Maddie.
Can you wait for the microphone so that everyone can hear?
Everyone can hear, yeah. Make sure the mic's on. I think we had a bit of trouble with the mic.
Hi.
Hello.
Yeah.
I was just wondering, regarding what you were saying earlier, for example, that people should give, for example, 5% of their income or more if they're earning more. With regards to those initiatives, do you think they should be made law, or is the element of choice also quite important to them?
I don't think you could make that law unless you had strong public support for it. And at the moment, there would not be support for that. So at the moment, as I say, you know, the government is taking from general revenue about 0.3%, the 35 cents in every dollar. And there seems to be reasonable public support for that. But you would need to have a society that was more educated and more aware about these issues. If you take a society like Sweden or Denmark, perhaps, well, there you have a public that does support around 1% or close to that for foreign aid, and there's good support for that. So you can build up gradually. But I think we're a long way from the kinds of levels that I'm advocating, so that is going to have to remain voluntary for the foreseeable future.
A good space to watch would be in the UK. They actually tried to implement, or they were going to implement, enshrine 0.7%, which is what the Millennium Development Goals advocate as what's needed by wealthy countries to help help end extreme poverty. They did try to enshrine that into law, and it just didn't get passed about a month ago now. So it might be interesting to watch that space. Yeah, have this one.
Thank you for coming to talk to us tonight. I just have two things I want to ask. I guess one thing that concerns me with what's been talked about tonight is making the distinction between developed countries and developing countries. I just think that there is a lot of poverty in Australia, in particular demographics, and I think it's important to recognise that. And number two, with LBL, you know, people are prone to getting bored really quickly. So in the future, for LBL to continue to grow every year from, you know, this exponential growth, are there any changes? You know, what's the strategy to keep it interesting and keep it in mainstream media?
Great. Thanks. Peter, did you want to comment on the developing world?
Yes, I will. I have to say, with respect, I'm going to disagree with you. I don't think there are really, well, maybe I shouldn't say any Australians, but I don't think there are any Australians, you know, any significant numbers of Australians who are poor in the sense of the developing world. That is, you know, maybe there's someone very isolated who doesn't have the ability to claim the rights that you have as an Australian. But you know, every Australian has access to safe drinking water. Every Australian has access to sanitation facilities. Every Australian has access to some income. Maybe they don't use it well and therefore they're poor, but every, you know, has access to some poverty benefits that provide that. And very importantly, every Australian has access to free healthcare, and every Australian has, again, you know, unless you're living somewhere extremely remotely, and every Australian has access to education for their children, also free. So, you know, these are things that most of the people who are extremely poor in the world lack.
I suppose to touch on the question about LBL, firstly to note, that's an exciting question that I tackle with every day. That is, so there's no real golden answer, I suppose, because this is such a young campaign, only been happening for 2 years. So that's a question that me and the team are trying to approach, especially after this campaign finishes, and actually what does 2013 look like? So, but I suppose I agree, Australians do get bored by things. They try something, they've done it again. Don't need to do it the second or third time. But what you're doing the same every year is the $10 amount, is the 5 days, is the $2 a day. But the experience encapsulates so much more than that raw figures. Not only what your online experience looks like, hopefully our website will be completely different next year, and your offline experience with the different people that are around you doing it, the way that you approach the campaign, do you focus on approaching local media or approaching the local newspaper at Melbourne University, or do you focus on your inner circle? Like, there's a whole bunch of ways that you can take your individual campaign with LBL, but qualitatively within the $10, even within the $10 and $2 a day, people experience very different challenges every time they do it. I've done the LBL challenge twice now. First time I did it, I actually meticulously planned it out for quite a few hours over the weekend prior to starting on Monday, and I wasn't even hungry over the 5 days, and I actually even had quite a good amount of taste. Whereas I did it earlier this year, about 6 weeks ago, and did not put in the time and energy, and it was much more of a struggle and more eye-opening that way. So I think, hopefully, we'll explore ways that your offline and online, as an online peer-to-peer fundraising campaign, in a lot of ways, will be very different year to year. But also, I think we need to look at ways how we can message the campaign and hopefully question people about how they can change up their experience. So I hope that answers your question. Cool. We'll go down the front and then back.
Hi. Do you think that government corruption plays a big role in the poverty, in the level of poverty in these poor countries? Because I hear a lot about aid for things like agriculture and diseases and things. What about countering that kind of thing?
Well, I think the question of government poverty playing a role in government corruption playing a role in global poverty is one that is going to vary from country to country greatly. I mean, certainly there are countries, Zimbabwe would be an example today, where it's hard to work because there is a corrupt government, and it's not impossible, but it makes it much harder to work there than it does in other countries where you have, governments that are really trying quite hard to make a difference. You know, Sierra Leone, for example, where after a terrible civil war, we now have a reasonably stable government that is working to reduce poverty. So it just is going to depend on which countries you're talking about. And because, as I've made clear, I think in other things I'm saying, I really think we ought to try to get the biggest bang for our buck. We ought to try to use the dollars we have as effectively as possible to reduce global poverty. I think it's reasonable to say that you have to make some very hard decisions. And if it's difficult to work in a country because it has a corrupt government that won't let you go in there and just do your stuff without siphoning off some of what you're doing, you have to go elsewhere. It's a tragedy for the people of that country. But you have to say, you know, we hope in a few years this situation will change. You know, some countries like Sierra Leone, which were countries very difficult to work in, then things change and you can work in them. So I think you have to, at least at the moment, work where you can do the most good. And that means working either where the government isn't corrupt, hopefully, you have a good government, or maybe the government's corrupt but it is not really interested in some of the rural regions and will just let you do your stuff there anyway.
I think we've probably got time for two more questions. We had one up the back, lady at the back who had her hand up quite early, and I think this guy in there was next. Sorry, Jay.
I touched on this a little bit earlier, but I just wanted to ask, in your opinion, what is our obligation to the global poor when money isn't going to solve the problem, when it is about culture or about social circumstances?
What is our obligation when money isn't going to solve the problem, but it's about culture or social circumstances? Well, that's difficult, and it's going to depend on the situation and the culture, I think. You know, sometimes we can help to change the culture. It's a mistake to think of aid organisations as just going in there to provide more food or better agricultural techniques or to dig wells or something like that. So, for instance, Oxfam, this may be the American Oxfam, but they're all part of a sort of global coalition, had a campaign in Mozambique a few years ago, which was really to promote equality for women. So that was a cultural issue that was causing poverty, and it was very specific laws relating to the inheritance of property that were causing poverty, because property, a couple might live together in a home and might have a small farm, but the law said that if the husband dies, that all of that, their joint property, goes to his family. So the wife, who might have lived there, worked on the farm for 20 years, actually becomes propertyless on the death of her husband. And while obviously many families would be fine about that and say, of course, you must live there and continue to work the farm, if they wanted to and if there was some animosity or something like that, they could just throw her off and she would be penniless. So Oxfam worked with local groups. There were, you know, while that was consistent with the culture in many regions of Mozambique, there were also people, of course, who were aware that this is wrong and that this is not the way things ought to be. So there was a small local campaign to change that law and to change the culture about it. And Oxfam was able to support that in various ways. So I think you can sometimes change the culture as well, and we can work to contribute to that. We have to do it in a sensitive way, and you certainly just can't come out and say, well, that's not the way we do it in the West, so you must do it our way. But if you have indigenous local groups that you're supporting, then I think you can make a difference.
I suppose last question was just down here on the right. Yeah, it'd be good to have the microphone so everyone can hear the question.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for tonight. So what I'm interested in is, because tonight we've been mostly talking about a positive duty to the world's poor. We've been talking about how it's wrong that these people are poor, so therefore, because we're rich, we should do something about it. But going back to the idea of Australia's role in the world, do you think that this duty to the poor could be extended to a negative duty in the sense that we as citizens of Australia, of a rich country, and not just Australia, but citizens of New Zealand and United Kingdom and potentially United States and other Western European countries, do you think we have a duty to the poor in the sense that we support our governments and our governments actually have a role in making those people poor and keeping those people poor through acts of war, such as Australia's war in Afghanistan and Iraq and so forth?
Well, I'm not sure that it's governments that are doing, that are keeping people poor. And I don't think the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq really were keeping people poor, though, you know, they may have been having other harmful consequences to them. But Afghanistan was a very poor country before the war began there. And Iraq is not such a poor country, as I was saying. But I think the problem, if you're asking for these, you know, are there negative duties not to harm, really, is what you're asking, and are we harming in some way? I would say that yes, in some ways we are, but it's not so much through governments as through maybe the global economic order, which tends to be more the matter of global corporations sometimes and some of the trade policies. I mean, one of the things that, you know, probably people have heard about blood diamonds that fuel conflict because we buy diamonds from countries where actually the money goes to warlords. The same is true for some of the metals that are used in your phones and things of that sort. Another good example is oil. Now, you know, we have, again, talking about corrupt regimes in Africa, you have some countries, there's a very small country called Equatorial Guinea, which is one of the poorest countries in Africa. It has very poor life expectancy, lots of infant mortality, little education. But it's ruled by a dictator who is one of the wealthiest people on earth because it is an oil producer. And Western nations, I actually have no idea whether Australia gets any oil from Equatorial Guinea, but you know, other Western nations do, the United States does. And effectively, these oil companies have gone into Equatorial Guinea and said, we would like the rights to drill for oil and to take the oil and export it, and we will pay to the government this substantial royalty on the amount of oil produced. And they do that knowing that this is a dictatorial government that has no intention of using this money to help the population as a whole, but is only going to indulge in a big fleet of private planes and luxury cars, and this dictator has houses, mansions dotted around the world, and so on. So effectively, you know, I mean, they know that this dictator has no right to this oil. I mean, he was never elected. He just happened to have more men with machine guns than other people. So effectively, the oil belongs to the nation as a whole. He's stealing it by having taken power. And the oil companies are really receiving stolen goods, you know, gladly receiving stolen goods. And if we buy that oil, we're complicit in that. So I think there are examples like that where we are contributing to poverty, and certainly those things ought to be changed.
All right, I think we've wrapped up the questions. We're running a little bit late on time. Firstly, I'd like to thank Melbourne University for hosting this event and all of the other organisations involved, and everyone in the room for coming along. It's been incredibly insightful. Lastly, I wanted to thank Peter. Thank you so much for your insight on the issue of extreme poverty and the problems that the world's poor face, and our obligation as people of Australia, and the different nuances around how we can help solve the problem. So I want to thank you very much. And
thank you.
Part of saying thank you, I think we have a gift of appreciation. So thank you very much.